Firefighting is essential for our communities, but it's never been easy. Today, with increased heat loads and toxicity, the job's more dangerous than ever before. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop highly advanced safety equipment to protect us on the job. MSA's Globe Gear is performance and protection in perfect balance. It's designed to meet the challenges we face every day and to keep us safe and healthy during our careers and beyond. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
Nice music.
All right. Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Danny Sheridan. We're doing first two battalion chief tonight, and I got two unbelievable guests tonight. This is for me. This is like one of the best shows that I could even imagine doing. I've been holding off on doing this for a while, and the reason why we're doing what we're doing tonight is because recently in the news with things going on throughout the country, I just saw yesterday in Wisconsin there was some kind of rioting, and they had like 50 fires in Portland and Minneapolis. You know, they've been going through all sorts of fire duty, and I said this might be a great time to pull out a show that I wanted to do for a long time because it's got some kind of relevance, you know. So tonight with me, I have Lieutenant Ray Callanan from Ladder. He was a fireman in 55 truck and lieutenant in Ladder 17, my old company. Tommy Fox, who started out in 71 engine and
went to 55.
55 and wound up in the 6th Division eventually as the deputy chief.
Round that back where we started from.
Full circle.
Back where we started from is right.
That was it, Tommy.
So anyway, so you know, it's like the war years. It's become kind of popular now on Facebook. I see lots of postings about the war years. And what's funny about the war years is that I got on the job in 86. And I remember the guys all had been through the war years, most of them anyway. And when I got there, they told me, kid, you're about 10 years too late. You should have been here 10 years ago. And I felt, I always felt like I missed it, you know, like, like you just missed the train, you know, and there goes the train. And, you know, and I used to hear the war stories from the old timers, Jack Ryan, Mike Weldon, Patty Mack, Tommy Mahoney, guys over in 71 and 50, Charlie Marshall. Tall guy.
Oh, Charlie Marshall. What a guy he was. God.
Archie.
Amen, Tom.
Archie, you know.
Archie, of course.
So all these guys, you know. That was what a place to work, the 6th Division, the 14th Battalion, the 5-5 Battalion.
2-6 Battalion.
2-6. You know, it's just like, and it was just a tremendous amount of fire duty. And the old timers would tell me, kid, you know, we used to go up on the roof and you could see the rigs just lined up down the block. There would be four rigs just lined up waiting to take their turn. 17 truck had two sections. Which Ray or Tommy, I got a question. I never really was quite sure. Did the second section of 17 become 55 truck?
No. 55
no,
was made.
No,
they were just started the company. Captain Dwyer, who came from 17 truck, by the way.
Right.
And 88 engine. He was a lieutenant 17. He started the company. He got a lot of the guys. He got a lot of good firemen. He kind of handpicked a lot of great guys. So 55 was just started like that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something about that. Jack Dwyer, he handpicked those guys. 55 truck was way before the second sections, about a year.
Okay.
I think it was 68, Ray, September 68. But anyway, with 55 truck
July,
got in service.
July 68. Yep, July 68
yeah.
It was formed.
So
anyway,
I always thought like – Well, the 58 truck, was that 27-2? I always thought
yeah,
some of these 58 trucks.
58 truck, I think, was 27-2.
That was, yeah.
And then 59
was.
Truck was in the tin house.
59 truck was in the tin house.
They went up to 43 when
43
they calmed down.
Sedgwick Avenue.
So lots of second sections. 41 engine had two sections. 50 had two sections.
A 17 truck had two sections. There was a squad in with 73 engines.
Yeah. 82 and 31 had a
82. They had a TCU unit. Yeah. They had 85 engines.
Yeah.
They went with 59 truck, 85 engine, and so there was plenty of companies in that area. That's how much fire duty there was.
So this is how my impression. I got there in 1986, or about to burn down. I mean, just buildings were falling down. Fires. Even when I got there, we were using that towel ladder on a regular basis, and I would hear the stories because of the interchanging, and I'll get to that in a minute, but the amount of companies that were in that little area, second section.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you guys could explain to how they work, because I don't think guys understand what a second section is, but maybe some of the younger guys that are listening, couldn't get their head around why would a firehouse have two sections of a fire company, Was it my impression, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, like if the box came in, like 2180, 60 would go out, 83, and then another box would come in, 2202, and then the second section would go out and take that box. Is that how it worked, and they would just rotate through, or did they have their own boxes?
No, actually, I know that four blocks away, 156th Street, I know that 71 engine, who was only 56 at 156 to 159, they were third Duke. So 41-1 and 41-2 were first and second Duke.
So they went on the same box.
So they
the
went
engine
on the
companies
box.
The engine companies went a lot on the same box, but the trucks did not. The trucks, one of them went and then
right.
They almost always did go.
See, I remember I got a job. 55 truck was up on 159th and Park.
Yes.
And in with 71. Rescue 3 was in with 17 trucks. 60 was down with by themselves, I think, on 135th or 36th Street.
Oh, that was early.
Early.
When 60 was formed, and in the early days it was down there.
Yeah.
You know.
And then Rescue 3 moved up, and then 55.
Well, Rescue 3 left.
Rescue
2
was in 71's quarters.
Right. They were in with
71. Oh,
they left, and then 55 moved in.
So with all those companies, it was still that much fire duty where you would go to four or five fires a night.
Unbelievable.
Now, let me ask you a question. As far as the fire duty, when it was happening, when it was all happening, did you guys realize that it was abnormal, or did you just take it as like, this is just the way it is?
I thought everybody did this all the time. I didn't know that. We were picking up a little bit, but as far as doing it, we were damn glad to do it. So we had... I'm going to say we had fun, but it was a labor of love.
Well, Tommy, what year did you get on the job?
66. 66,
right?
67, my wife just told me.
I came in March of 70, so I was 4 years after you, Tom. So then, and like I said, this is what we went to work for. We didn't know. I didn't know if it was changed or this was it. This is all we knew.
Yeah. See, my father-in-law got on a job in 57. And he started it down in 33 engine, Hell's 100 Acres.
Right.
He was there for 9 years.
That was tough.
He told me, because we talked a lot about this, because he was a captain of 41 engine, and I was in 17 truck, which was interesting. But he would tell me that he went up after 9 years in 33 engine. He taught 6 months in probie school. Then he got assigned to the second section of 50. He said there were guys there that he taught in probie school that had done more fire duty than he did. In 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
It was true.
Yeah.
It didn't take you long to catch your first job, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know, in hindsight now, I see how the job is now. And, I mean, you guys could not imagine how much has changed. I mean, even when I came on a job, we didn't have bunker gear. We didn't have, you name it, we didn't have it. I know that you guys didn't really have masks back then.
We had the masks, but unfortunately, we weren't smart enough to use them.
Right.
All the time. You had to use them. But at certain times, you had to use them. They used to be in a suitcase.
Right.
And we have to carry them up. Certain guys put them on.
Well, they might send you back to get them. They might send you back downstairs to get one.
Back to get one. There you go, Tom. Exactly.
I think what was taught to me, especially when we had a vacant, that, I wasn't really supposed to wear a mask. I was supposed to show how, I could take a feed. And that was normal. And in the bucket, don't even think about bringing a mask up in a bucket. And I have to tell you, sometimes I caught some tremendous beatings in a bucket, you know. And
a towel ladder.
So, you know, it's just, you know, tell me, you know, one thing about the interchange, because I know that my father-in-law would tell me, he called it work relief. Did you guys like interchange, or did you rather not do it?
Well, Tommy, you'll have to answer that question in 71 engine, because 55 was the only truck of the 6th Division that didn't have an interchange.
And nobody really liked it. The young guys hated it, and the older guys were a little bit better with it. But the young guys, they wanted to stay there and do all the runs they could and all the work they could. It was like combat, you know. It's like unbelievable. The guys were dying to come to work. I hope we get a good job tonight. You know, everything like that. It was unbelievable, you know. Everybody was so motivated. Like it's.
Oh yeah, but I remember working at the 50 engine, and they left me back. They used to leave a C&I guy back, and the guys from Queens were all talking. They were all in their 40s, and most of them, you know, they weren't really looking forward to having a crazy night. But they did what they had to do. You know, so. We all like being home. You know what I mean? And
yeah, I remember. See, I don't think the country understands how we work. You know, we have the 25. A group chart, and you try to explain it to guys around the country, and they're like, well, we do the ABC or ABCD, I'm not sure, depending, and they do straight 24s, they do 7 to 7 or whatever is 8 to 8, and the guys in 17 truck would tell me that they couldn't do a 24 because they would get so beat up in a night tour, they would go home, put the black shutters up or the blinds and try to get a few hours sleep because they have to come back for the next night tour. You know, and I know that sometimes guys would just stay in the Bronx. A lot of guys lived in the city at the time. And, you know, they would find things to do in between tours.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, guys would go fishing. They go out for lunch. but you know, we know what that all meant. But, of course, it was great. And the 24s came along. You know, we just adjusted. You made the adjustments.
Hey, Tommy, did the 24s ruin the job?
Not for me.
No, I don't think so.
I was one of those guys that I had an outside job. I worked all the time. I had worked on the outside, after I had a year in the job. So they were pretty good for me. But I still, you know, I love to still go to the firehouse. You know, they didn't change too much for me. I was in the same amount of time. But I did like 24s. I didn't like them. I think everybody loves them now. I don't think there's such a thing.
Yeah. I have to tell you, when I got on the job, I lived in Woodside in Queens, and I think the toll was like 50 cents or something. And I really liked working my straight tours. You know, I was like, what happened was all the senior guys lived upstate, so they all grabbed me to do a 24, and I wanted to work my straight tours because I just love going to work so much, you know. But, it was really you know, in hindsight now, even though the senior guys told me that I missed it, I'm looking now in comparison, and some of the younger guys think that I've been through the war years, and I try to explain to them that, like, I don't even have a scratch of the surface of what you guys went through, you know? And, in fairness, we did have some busy times. I left the truck company, went to the squad, and, you know, we did okay in the swing, you know. Some of the things, you know, I'm trying to think about, like, I know some of the memorable fires in the South Bronx, like the Jennings Street collapse. Ray said you came in that night?
I worked that night, Tom, and I was in 55. We caught a job, and we went sick. It was a good job. We were in Fulton Hospital. And then we heard about this Jennings Street collapse. And then, of course, we didn't realize how bad it was, but the miracles that happened that nobody was killed in. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Guys went down six stories. And, you know, the building collapsed, the whole interior collapsed. I mean, it was amazing that, you know, they dug guys out. And it's just an amazing thing that everybody lived. You know, so that was somebody was watching over us that night, that's for sure.
Well, I certainly believe that. And that was another broadcast that I did one time. We called it, like, you know, like just the invisible hand of all this stuff that, you know, God protecting the firefighters. Because I could remember myself, a vacant building on Christmas Eve. You know, one or two guys go down, and, you know, they lived. Cortland Avenue, we had another collapse just within a month of each other, you know.
Oh, and, yeah, I remember them, too.
There was just so many collapses, you know.
I think when you talk about the war years, you would say when you were coming to work in the morning, you would be on the Bruckner, and you'd see smoke in two or three different places. You'd see the smoke billowing, or the fire was out. And you just knew that, you know, what kind of a night. You woke up, the South Bronx was burning, and actually you'd be in one building and you could see another building on fire. Well, we pulled into a block at night. I was working in 19 truck, and the chief said, you got one building on the right, building on the left. Take whichever one you want.
Yeah.
But that's what he's talking about with the war years. That was it. But, yeah. You know, there was very few loss of life. It was a different... Buildings were different. The glass wasn't the same. There wasn't so many plastics. So,
right.
You know, you could do a lot.
And there was no R&R either. When you came back and you got a box, you went. You know what I mean? There was no R&R. You went back to the thing in them first few years because everybody was out all the time. If you got back to quarters and it was a fire in your quarters, you took it in, you know.
There you go. There was a chief. One chief, Tom, had very bad arthritis. And I can't think of his name. And he says, I want you guys to take a half an hour or 45 minutes, you know, clean up or something like that. We never heard of it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You come back from the job and you get a run on a radio to another job. That was normal. But then, later on we thought about taking a rest was okay.
That's so funny, though. Like, you never really wanted to miss a job. I remember, like,
oh, God.
We had I remember one night we had this really good job. I can't remember if it was occupied or vacant, whatever it was. And we came back. And we had, I guess the work had moved up north on the west side. So they were, you know, they looked it down upon us, like relocating down to us now, you know. And
like 75 and 33. Yeah.
They couldn't wait to get out of the firehouse. And one, the engine was like, hey, take all the time you want. And a good fire came in right after that. And we had a Proby. And he had to take a shower. So the whole company had to, like, wait for him. Let me tell you something. He caught hell.
Oh, yeah.
No one took a shower. It's just like, you know, you want to go to the next one, you know. And
I don't know if in Park Avenue if we even had a shower. I mean, there was the bathroom had there was stuff piled up in the showers. I always remember going home and taking a shower.
I think in 17 truck we had one shower on the third floor.
Yeah.
It was up, you know, like up in that back room, there was one little shower, and the officer had a shower.
I mean, it's great. It was definitely different than
there was,
today.
There was one shower, and the other, there was two of them together, but only one of them worked. And then the other thing was every other thing in the firehouse that you had to stand and hide away, or stand was in that other shower, you know. Brooms, mops, pails, every other damn thing. But
that was it.
But it was a shit little shower anyway.
We did, don't forget, you know better than me, Tom, but when we went on the job, we worked at World War II, guys. I mean, that was the era.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That was the end of their era, and they were just unbelievable brothers, as we called them, that we worked with. It was amazing. Some of the greatest guys in the world.
Yeah, I remember when I came on a job, I worked with the Vietnam vets, you know, guys like Tom Cree, Frank Trum, you know, all these, like, Vietnam vets. And, you know, I think they were all cut from the same mold, you know, because they're used to the combat, and then they come into work, and it's almost, I guess, the same feel, I guess, the same mindset, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as far as, like, you know, memorable fires, you know, I have, like, three that I could think of. You know, one when I was lieutenant in 58 engine, one when I was a captain in 96 engine, and I had, you know, one when I was in 17 truck. You know, is there any, like Tommy, that one fire that just sticks out when you were a fireman that, like, maybe could have went the other way and it didn't, and, you know, or just, because there's got to be one or two that kind of, I know Ray told me one, but I'd like to, we're going to ask Ray tell his story, but what about you, like, Tommy, any memorable ones?
Are you talking about the Trade Center now, or are you talking about the
That was an anomaly. But just when you were in 71, or even when you're a lieutenant, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I had a couple of good fires in 71 that I thought that it was the end of the world, you know. Because actually, the nozzle guy hadn't had no mask then, and neither the next guy. The mask guy was down the road a bit, you know. We used to push in and lay down, push in as much as I can, and then I don't know what the hell happened, but I couldn't breathe for shit. I couldn't breathe. I said, I got to get out of here, but it was 18 guys behind me. I said, gee, I guess I'm going to die here, you know what I mean? But all of a sudden, we just put the line over our head and wet us all down, and we all survived that. You know? But for a minute there, I said, oh, my goodness, this job is... And I already had 3 or 4 years on a job by that time. I knew it was something, but it's amazing.
And who was your lieutenant then, Tom? Was it Dave Murphy?
Yeah, Dave Murphy. He was a tough guy, but a great guy.
A tough guy, that's the way it was.
Yeah. Ray, what was your story?
It was a pleasure.
You were working in 19 truck. You were in the window and it.
Tom, I don't know if you were working, but I'm working in 19 truck. We were doing the when you work from 6 to midnight. When we were the fire team. I think I'm still a probie. We go to Eagle Avenue. Bill Bodie's wild man Bill was driving 19 truck. Me and this guy, Slow Murphy, go up the aerial ladder into the floor above on Eagle Avenue. Meanwhile, the building is roaring on the other side, 156th Street. So I get up there. Now I got, he's gone. The other guy's gone. He took off and I'm by myself above the fire. Then I'm going, I can't see nothing. I hear crackling. I say, oh. Sounds like it's, you know, I better get back. I go back to the window. The aerial's gone. And I'm standing there with my
God.
The light's going. 55 pulls up. At Ralph Everett's driving. The bro, Tom Killeen, up the ladder. Get the hell out of there. To the bottom of the aerial ladder. That room was fully involved.
Yeah.
I was a stupid probie all by yourself. Today, if you want to go to the floor above, you got to get permission from the...
Yeah,
you know, you got to let people know. You'll tell them, Danny. You don't just go to the floor above.
I had one that I remember. I was a probie, myself and Frank Simpson. We came together. We had a job earlier on 149 in Brook. It was a vacant. And, you know, we were there for, I don't know, like an hour or two work. And Tony Alva was there for 6 hours. The captain went out to ABC. So Tony was there just for 6 hours. And he was at the time the captain of 19 truck.
19 truck, yep.
And
it was,
we go to this job. I think someone got injured, and they took a guy from the engine and put him on the roof, and they kept me and Frank on the inside. So we have this brownstone. We get another job about an hour later, and Frank and I, well, Dennis Calliope was working in 60 engine. He was covering.
He's a great guy.
He was doing overtime, and Alva is in a truck. So Dennis goes in, crawls in on his belly, goes up right up to the fire room. Everything's good. And Tony, you know, takes me and Frank, you know, we come in and we don't know what the hell we're doing. We're both probies, you know. And something happened, but Tony says, get out. And me and Frank just, like, had no clue what was going on. He grabs the both of us, like two little kids, turns us, throws us, and said, get out. And so we go about 10, 20 feet down this hallway, and the fire is roaring at us now, and it blows over our head. He grabs the two of us. When I say get out, I mean now, you know. And me and Frank, we were just looking at him like two school kids, you know. And, you know, it's funny, like, being older now and being on a job for 34 years, I know exactly what happened that night. It was very similar to a Cherry Road fire or that fire in Boston on our beacon. You know, it had a lot to do, and it was really nobody's fault. Back then, not everybody had radios. And the OV was doing what he was supposed to do, and the roof made a little bit of a mistake. And, you know, he tried to cut a corner here and there, and, you know, we almost paid the price for it. But I always, to this, I thank God for Tony Alva. He put him there that day because I think, like, what if we had a young guy, you know, like some new lieutenant from wherever.
Trying to make it show that he could do it.
You know, and, like, Tony just knew, and I have no idea what he sensed, but he knew something wasn't right, and he got us out. And, you know, there's so many stories like that, you know. Billy Larson told me a great story one time, very similar. You know, he said that some like Billy was good with that. Like,
oh, Billy paid attention. Yeah.
He even though he's a fireman, he acted like a chief. He always had this sixth sense. Like twice he saved my life, like guaranteed saved my life. And he told me his own personal story one time. He just had a gut feeling, you know. And I think today, in today's fire environment, what's different than from when you guys were fighting them? You wore, I'm sure, just Ray. You probably had the truckie boots with the jeans and the half coat.
The jeans, exactly right.
No hood.
Sure,
no,
yeah.
Barely had gloves on, I'm sure. And you felt it. You know, you could
felt the heat.
You could read the
going
on.
No hood, like you said, yeah.
Yeah, you could listen. How many times I got to the door? You could get in about 10, 15 feet, and you say, okay. You tell the engine, it's in here. You know. And, you know, kids today, they come in and they got hoods on. And
you're encapsulated.
You know, well, Ray wore the bunker gear for
a
while.
Yeah. Quarterback bunker. I retired in 05.
Yeah, so Ray probably wore it for a good 10 years.
Yeah.
Tommy, I don't think you ever wore the bunker gear.
I did. I worked at
You would.
I was in a captain and a lieutenant 58 engine. You know, 58 was a real good, fire company. We had a million. Our own fire every single night, you know, it's small. It was, we were first due everywhere and we had fires, but, yeah, we did have bunker gear, I guess the last 3 or 4 years that I was there, but then I got promoted to chief. We didn't have many, I didn't wear them anymore anyway, you know, but, we didn't have radios in 1968. We didn't get the radios. I think in 70.
Yeah.
Ray, you remember having radios when you came?
No, not at all, Tom. I mean, no, I think
no radios. And I'm almost positive. The chauffeur got the roof. The chauffeur put the aerial to the roof and went up and got it. It was kind of a grab ass kind of thing. You do this and you do that. There was no organization to it at all. We're lucky.
When I came in, Tom, Lattice 3 was in when I came in. I learned out in Proby School. So I think the roof man had a radio. That was it, though. You know, just the officer and I think the roof man, he had to have one.
Engine,
you used to say the roof is open.
Right. Right, and then the engine. I think the officer and the chauffeur.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
I didn't have a radio.
You have to radio start water.
Yeah. I didn't have a radio.
We were yelling down the stairs, yelling down, start water, start water, start water, start water.
Hand signal too, Tom.
Yeah,
hand signal too. They did from a window.
You do like the thumbs up.
Yeah,
start water. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And 2.5 inch line, you know.
Well, Patty Mac told me. He said 60 because they had so many railroad flats. He said that they would just stretch 2.5 because it was a straight run right down the hallway. So
2.5 inch lines were unbelievable. I mean, I remember being up behind Russ Williams with a 2.5 inch line, and I couldn't believe the fire we put out. He put out.
Yeah, it put out a lot of fire.
Yeah,
2.5.
Yeah. It really was good.
And you guys didn't use. Tommy, you guys never used a fog nozzle, did you?
Yeah, sure. Fog nozzles, when I was first a lieutenant, they were quite the fashion. You know, they were going through all this. There was a lot of going on in the truck. The engine trying to fog nozzles. They absorb more heat and then the other thing because they're smaller particles and all that stuff. But it was horseshit. The heat would just burn. We turn the steam immediately right in front of your face instead of in the 10 feet down, you know. Oh, everybody tried it, and then kind of on our own, like, you know, when I was a lieutenant 50, we had a fog. No, when I worked, I didn't let him have the fog nozzle. I had another nozzle, and I even had the bore drilled out. It was like an inch and an eighth, whatever. I had drilled out as much I could possibly do to shave it down. You know?
Tommy, what year were you a lieutenant 58 engine in Harlem? I was there in 99 to like after 9/11.
Oh,
and
no,
you're right.
I was there about.
We had
I was there 77 to 82. And then I was a lieutenant. Then I come back as a captain from like 84 to 90. Something like that. I was there.
Wow, Tom. That was great.
Yeah.
Let me tell you one thing about 58 Engine. Phenomenal engine company. I am telling you, that engine company. I would follow them into hell because they had some guys. You probably work with Mookie and Brickman and the Brick.
Wait, the Brick,
there was some
Well, you're also, he's also talking about company pride, you know, that, hey, this is, we're 71 engine, we're 58 engine, yeah. we ain't leaving until we did our job or something like that. And it was,
that's right,
it was a bragging rights, you know, that they were good. It was something to say they were a good engine company. You didn't have to say any more than that.
58, you know, 26 used to say 58 makes us great. And you know, one thing too, like for the young guys, and you touched on it, Ray and Tommy, you know, going above, right? You had the floor above teams in this between 6 and 10 or whatever it was, or after tweeted, whatever. And I remember, you know, as an engine boss, I love being an engine boss. I love being right up there with the nozzle, you know. And I remember being in the truck, and in 17, you know, we did a fair bit of secondary work down with 83 and 29, up with 71 and 55, and you always made sure you check with the engine boss, hey, we're going above. Like, you know, I remember Frank O'Grady one time. We had a job. I was young, maybe a year or two on a job. And we had a job on 138 in St. Anne's. Good job. We were there all the time. They were trying to get rid of the building or whatever. And you know, he held us back. Like, he would not let us go above.
O'Grady.
Yeah. He's like, we're not going above.
He came
above.
For 42 trucks, so yeah. O'Grady. So he had his.
He said, you're not going above until there's water. And he held us back. He would
of
not
course.
Let us go above. We were pissed. But you know what? He was right. Because they had no water on the fire. There was no water in the
that's
line.
Right.
They sat by the hydrant, you know. And
actual right away to get water.
You know, he was, you know, and that's a good officer because he's looking out for the firefighters. You know, he's got experience. He had 25, 30 years, whatever at the time. Me and Matt Hansen had probably 2 years between us, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're ready to go, chomping at the bit. And, you know, the floor above, you know, that's. Some place to be, right?
Some place to be, right, exactly. It's in the fire below you, and you don't know how much or where or anything like that. So,
you know what I learned about going above? Because we did a lot of stuff on the floor above. I remember we had a job down on Willis on the other side of the Deegan, and it was a railroad flat. And I'll tell you one thing. You know, it's a joke, you know, the odd couple, never assume, right? You know, Felix says, never assume. And I remember we went above, and I took a little bit of a risk. And it was a railroad flat, and I just said, well, if things go bad, you know, I got the towel out of there. Well, sure enough, things went bad, and I'm go to the window, and the towel ladder is up on the roof.
Not there.
With the roof.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I said, well, I'll go out the other door, because, you know, they had that second door, and it's all boarded up. So now I'm crawling back on my belly with the fire over my head, and I'm like... So just, you know, an advice to the young guys. And, you know, I did this, too, on 138th Street. We had a lot of tenants with no rear fire escapes. And I did the same thing, thinking I'll just pop out of a fire escape. And sure enough.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Fire. Yeah. So, you know, you got to do a good size up, you know, with these guys. So, anyway, we're about halfway through. And I purposely didn't give out the call-in number because I wanted to really get some – I wanted you guys to talk before I put the number out there. But if anybody out there wants to talk to Ray or Tommy, the number is 760-454-8852. That's our call-in number, 760-454-8852. So anyway, so Tommy, you were a deputy chief. I'm on the list now, which I'm not holding much hope anymore. I got 3 years left on the list, but given the current situation,
I know,
with the economy or whatnot, I'm wondering if where the hope is, you know. But who knows, you know, we gotta take it as it comes.
You'll be surprised. Some, you know, things happen quick, you know, a whole bunch of guys you get out, all of a sudden, you know.
You know, as far as moving up the ranks, Ray was a lieutenant. It's funny, I could so picture Ray in 55 truck when you're on 159th Street driving that truck.
Oh, yeah.
He was the chauffeur of 55. I must have been in race groups because I saw him all the time, you know?
I'd always run him with Joe Kelly.
And Joe was in my groups, yeah.
Joe was inside. I'd always see him and Jack Ryan. And yeah. I love being the chauffeur of 55.
You know, it was just a great division. The 6th Division had a great reputation. You know, it's no secret that a lot of people look up to the FDNY. And we look, they're looked up upon, not because of me, because of you guys. You're the ones that, like, kind of, you know, cut the, you know, cut the mold there, you know. And it's like the, you know, if the FDNY is the Yankees, you're the 27 Yankees, you know.
Yeah.
And it just amazes me that, like, when you were in it, I was the same way. I'm like, I thought it was normal to go to work in a building collapse or get caught in a flashover or, you know, have two like, I thought this was all normal, you know. And now I look back on it as a chief and, you know, I haven't seen stuff like that.
You hope it ain't.
Exactly.
But, you know, I'm sorry, Ray. But what I was getting at is that a lot of the country is starting to see this now. And as a chief, this is what I'm leading into, is that, you know, I have to tell you, I'll give you an, I'll give you a story. It was a vacant building we had on 100, and it was a frame. It was up in 158th Street in like 3rd Avenue. It was Patty Mack's last night tour. He was senior man at 60 Engine, and they gave him the nozzle. And the chief was a guy named Slevin.
Jimmy Slevin. Yeah.
He was acting deputy chief. And anyway, we come up as a tower ladder, 60 Engine's there. And he's in front of the building. I could so remember this. Like, he's in front of the building, and everyone's chomping at the bit to go in, and he's like, nobody in the building. And we're like, come on. You know, like.
Yeah.
And like, he was very adamant about nobody in the building, right? So, the heck with it. So I'm in a bucket with this other guy, Bobby Wright. We're in the bucket, knocking down all the fire. All the fire is knocked down. And we start working on a cornice, right? So I'm pulling a cornice. And I look at Bobby. I'm like, why did you move the bucket? He says, I didn't move the bucket. The building collapsed. You know? So every time I see, he smiles at me. He goes, tell my son the story about, you know, the vacant, you know?
Oh, man.
But, you know, you know, it's fun. As a deputy, even a battalion chief like myself, you know, I use that experience. I had a vacant down on Timpson Place in like 149, and I saw the SIDS. I got right on the radio. I picked up the radio. I said, nobody goes in that building until I get there. And I didn't let no one in that building, you know. But it's the job of a deputy, you know, and the stuff that's going on now, the deputy's got to put his foot down. Got it, you know.
Yeah.
Hold it. Well, some people back is a big thing. You're right. Those guys are aggressive.
I mean, so Tommy, what was like a trick? Like, you know, what, like, you know, I give you credit because I know that I've been to vacant buildings where we've had three or four lines in there and we're in there and we had no business being in these buildings, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We got away with it. I don't know. If I could do that as a chief today, like, I don't know if I would allow a guy to, you know, guys to go into a building with three floors of fire, like, you know?
Yeah. But, yeah. I always, when I was a battalion chief, I always managed to get myself a look at it. Like, you know, just, you know, I never really was minded anybody's back, but I try to get in and see what the hell was going on, even if it was 10 seconds, you know what I mean? Then I try to always know my guys, too, pretty well. If you're in any place a long time, you know all the lieutenants and captains pretty damn good. You know what I mean? Some of them have more sense than others, and some of them don't, you know. So you're on the scene there. And battalion chief, when you know battalion chiefs, you know them a long, long time. They're reasonable guys. They're not going to let anybody get in their buildings, you know. And you got to come down on them real hard. When you know they can't go in there, you got to make it your business to say, hey, you're not going in there. Case closed. And once they're in, you ain't getting them out. You know, it's real hard like that.
That's it. You're not getting them out.
Yeah. Just one more room. One more room.
So, like, I've heard that how many times? Yeah. You know, Jimmy Johnson, I could see in 60 Engine. Yeah, we got it. Brown Places. 100 windows of fire. We got it, you know? Like, how do you deal with that? You know, like you just got to just put the foot down and say, listen, out now.
You got to go with it. And, you know. Yeah. Better safe than sorry. That's the answer.
I know a story, and I'm getting conflicting reports on who it was. I thought it was Tom Roby, but then now someone said it might have been John Newell, but it was the 16th Battalion, regardless. They had a vacant over on Lenox. They were in there. three engines, two trucks, whatever. They're all in there for a while. And the chief, whether it was Roby or John Newell, I'm not sure who it was, says to his aide, "Hey, we have any SIDS on this?" You ever hear that story, Ray?
Nope.
He says, "Tommy, have you heard the story?" I don't know when it happened, but he said, "Is there any
SIDS
on it?"
I don't think so.
So anyway, it's Lennox, and the aide gets back to him, "Chief, the SIDS for 300 Lennox, whatever it was, absolutely under no condition should anybody be in that building." He gets on the radio, urgent, everybody out of the building. Do you know when the last guy come out of the building, it collapsed?
Yeah, holy shit.
True story. I've heard that from numerous sources, and I haven't nailed down who the chief was. I've heard two different chiefs, but that's a true story, you know. And
nobody sees Roby anymore. Roby moved away, and I would love to see him. Everybody would love to see him.
Right. Well, so, you know, as a deputy now, with these guys that are starting to experience some of this fire duty, it's up to the chiefs, really. You know, the incident command.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and now,
you have to be.
And
go ahead.
I would say not only that, but they're dealing also with a very hostile public. I remember we would go to some boxes up by you guys, up by 71 and 55 in the projects on Cortland and, you know, and we would be getting attacked. You know, we were getting attacked by the civilians. We're trying to go to a fire and, you know.
Really? Yeah.
We're getting, you know. And I remember Frank Trum almost getting into like a, you know, like a rumble with the civilians. We're trying to go up and they're telling us like, you know, stay out, you know. So, you know, this is some of the things that I think what's happening now in the country is that these are things that the some of the chiefs have to deal with. And I think what they're going to have to maybe think about, like you guys did, I don't know, did you ever do that AUC 138 with the police car formation?
Oh, yeah, we had that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Emergency command procedure. Yeah, I remember that.
We had to follow the police cars into the block.
I mean, I
we had our first rig had a wooden roof. It was a 58 Mac with a wooden roof. What a piece of junk that was. And we had that from 1974. We got a 74 Seagraves after that. But it was unbelievable. But usually the people... Most of the people appreciated us, I thought.
I remember going down to Michigan Oak and cornices coming off, you know, flying off the rig, off the rooftops, you know, hitting the rig.
Yeah.
Give me some.
But in my experience when I came there, we had really pretty good relations every time we had a fire with anybody. That started, like, I'm going to say around, I don't know, 85, 86, when that, and it's going to get worse when the cops are getting the shit beat out of them now. Our guys, very soon after, it's just going to keep on rolling down the road, you know. And you thought you are right. Not only chiefs, everybody's got to take care of this stuff, our guys, you know. It's
exactly,
going to be horrible.
Tom. It is.
Yeah, I think that's something that has to be brought into the equation, because I think some of these places are getting blindsided now because they probably go to one or two fires a week or whatever, and now all of a sudden they got 50 fires going on, you know? So anyway, what I want to do is I wanted to finish on a different note. Tommy, you have an unbelievable story that needs to be documented for all time. I have my own 9/11 story. I remember that day so vividly. I was home. I wasn't working. I was in 58 engine at the time. 58 did respond. I remember it was the Monday night. I saw Tommy Riley's daughter. Remember Tommy? He was the aide that used to drive up.
We all knew Tommy.
O'Hagan.
He was also in the union.
Yeah, he was a union guy. I knew his daughter. And she was telling me about the mass at 73 and 42 with Father Mike Judge and all these guys.
Yeah.
Field, all these there. And I was, like, so annoyed. I was like, I should have went to that mass, you know.
I went.
And,
I was there.
You were there, Tom? Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
It was like,
they lost a lot of guys that were at that mass.
Yeah. So I remember the next morning, because it was my wife's birthday that night, and I remember the next morning getting – my two oldest girls off on the bus, and my youngest was only kindergarten. I had to drive her to school, nursery school, or kindergarten. And I heard the, you know, I heard it on the radio, and I thought it was like some kind of like a fluke. I said, it's got to be a small plane or whatever. And long story short, I packed up. I was working Tuesday night anyway, so I said, let me get down there. And I got to the firehouse, and 58 had responded. And they had a pretty senior crew, and they got caught in the collapse. And unfortunately, we lost the lieutenant. And, it was kind of a blur after that. You know, there was a lot of, like, stories that I heard. I heard that there was a convoy of 6th Division companies, of 14th Division companies,
yeah,
that were held up at the tunnels or at the bridges, and it delayed them enough to not be at the collapse.
There was 1,000 stories.
And, Ray, your story,
yeah,
was you weren't working that day, but you went – I think you were working
– I had to go – I went to the firehouse, and 17 was down there. They relocated to 15. They sent them down. This is the second tower came down, so we had to wait. They wouldn't let us go. We had to wait in the firehouse all day. And then they came back, and that was it. We still had a man in the firehouse, and I got down there on day two because I got off, and we just went down. We volunteered to go down, and we went down.
Yep.
And
so
we did what we had to do.
So Tommy, now you were a deputy at this point. Where were you in the 6th Division at this point?
I was in the 6th Division. Yeah. I went to the 15th Division, and then I got back to the 6th after I forget who, maybe Kennedy or someone at that time. But you know, if you don't realize that was primary day, that Tuesday.
Yeah.
And we used to support all the candidates for the primary, stuff like that. So I was on my way down already. You know, I was driving over the Tappan Zee Bridge when I said a plane hit the thing. And I kept thinking about when we were kids, a plane hit the Empire State Building. I don't know if you guys realize that, but it was a small plane. And that's what I thought happened again. You know?
1945.
Yeah. And that plane burned out that floor only, Ray. That was class one, fireproof. Yeah, the Empire State Building. And it burned out one floor only. That's it. It was so good of structural. Okay. Anyway, I went down to the firehouse. And then as soon as we got down, we went down and started watching on TV and realizing. Then the second plane hit, and we got a bus. We went out, stopped the bus. And there was cops across the street. And I think 48 of us, everybody knew about it. We got on a bus, and we went down there. And it was tough going down. The bus driver, you know, threw everybody off the bus, took us. We were down on the bus all the way down to the Trade Center. And then just when we got there, the second tower. And then we had to stop. We walked from the drive all the way across. It was like snowing, you know. You couldn't even see.
Yeah.
Like that.
That's exactly right.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, people were walking around in like zombies. Yeah,
walking over the Brooklyn Bridge, uptown. Anyway, they didn't know what the hell to do. But they were glad to see us, too. I knew it looked like we were going toward the place. And they said, well, these guys will probably do something. But we didn't know what the hell we were getting into at all, you know.
Not bad.
And
yeah, I remember driving down from Mayapack. I was cranking. I had a four-cylinder Honda, and I had that thing up to like 90 miles an hour. And I got to the firehouse. We did the same thing. I was the first guy in. Guys started coming in. I got a bus on Fifth Avenue. You know, I called the guy. I said, listen, we need a bus. And we went down. We went to 53 and 43. Then we went over to 22 and 13, 91 engine. And then we went down. And we came down the east side and came around the bottom. And we saw 15 trucks. I told the guys, get every piece of equipment off 15 truck, airbags, first tools, just saws, whatever they got, just take them off. And we started walking up, and it was like nothing like I can't even imagine. You know, I got to that Liberty Street, and I ran into a friend of mine. He was in rescue, too. And I said, Paulie, I said, were you working? And he looked at me with a deadpan face, and he said, Danny, he says, if I was working, I'd be dead right now. And, wow, it just hit me like a slug, you know. And my goal was I wanted to find 58 because I knew they were there. And I ran into one of my guys, and they were so banged up. And I have to tell you, this is one of the most heroic stories. And they don't like talking about the story, but the lieutenant's name was Bobby Nagel.
Sure, I know Bobby well.
Yeah, he was there with Joe Marchbanks.
Oh, boy.
Freddie Sheffield
Freddie
was there.
Sheffield
Freddie was with them.
12th Battalion.
Yeah, the 12th. And they were in the lobby of the hotel. And I finally got to the lobby, and I saw this yellow rope, And the guys were really humble about it. And they told me what happened, that Bobby, his only concern was about the probie that was working. How's the probie? And they're trying to dig him out because he's buried. They can still talk to him. They threw a rope down to him. Once they threw the rope down to him, he was on it. They were still digging their way. And then a second collapse occurred. They stayed with him the whole time, but the rope had gotten cut in half. And Bobby had just disappeared. And, you know, we never really found him. But these guys were so heroic. And that was just so typical 58 because they were just tough guys, you know, and they weren't leaving Bobby, you know. But anyway, so we were down there for a few weeks, and then you had come back at some point later. And maybe I should just let you tell the story because it's quite an amazing story.
I know the story, Tom. Yeah. That's why I think you should tell it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, this was like I was down there that day with you, too, and I went over to I forget what street it was on the east side of the collapses and all that kind of stuff. And I was there.
Yeah, well, Nick Visconti was running that whole side over there. Remember Nick was running that?
Yeah. And I actually didn't come back until September 12th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when I ended up going home, you know.
Right.
The worst thing about that, to me, that we didn't find anybody alive. Like, I kind of had on my head, when I saw that plane hit on TV, I knew that I thought that it was going to topple. You know, I never in my wildest thought it was going to collapse like that.
Me too.
But
when
it did, I said, my God, we're going to have hundreds and hundreds of people dead here. But I just, when we got to the site, and I thought it'd be people all over the place that we'd be pulling out, and this, we didn't get anybody. Like, everybody that we got, it was heartbreaking for me that we didn't get anybody. I said, oh, my God almighty, where did we? But we kept plugging away there, and we ended up, we got a couple of people on the other side, but they didn't make it, you know what I mean? But to get to my story is, I was down there really a lot. Like, I was down there on the 14th. Like, I went home. I was down there. I went home the 12th off 2 days. I went back again. And then I was there all of October. I was there a long time. Sometime in October, truthfully, I can't tell you the date. And now we're on the West Street side. And we got two horses with a piece of plywood hooked up, sometime in the middle. And there's all kind of guys. I couldn't tell you, but I would say there was 800 guys on a pile. And, you know, it was a 16-story pile. It's
yes.
8 acres around, you know what I mean? And it was guys all over the damn place. So I'm standing there, and everybody's calling you, and it was really, really busy. And all of a sudden, my aide says to me, there's a guy here on the back here. He wants to speak to you a minute. And I said, tell him to get the fuck out of here. I'm sorry. You know, I was upset. Like, I didn't really want anybody telling me what to do. My mind was, don't get anybody hurt and further in this mess already we got here. Let's try to keep everybody that down here as safe as we possibly can. So now,
dangerous.
I say, all right. I look around and, go ahead. There's a guy behind me about 3 or 4 feet. He's about a lot shorter than me. He has a blue hard hat on. And he says, hey, Chief, are you in charge of this area here? I says, yeah, I am. He said, I don't know if you recall, remember the pieces of steel that were sticking up out of the rubble?
Yeah.
Like, you see it many times on TV. And I said, yeah. So this guy's all up and down of that thing on every single side of the pile, up and down. You could count them. They were like ants all over the place, you know.
Hell yeah.
So this guy says to me, listen, Chief, that doesn't look too good to me. It didn't look too good to me either, but I didn't know what to do, you know. He says, I think that thing's going to fall down, or at least slide down where that steel is. So I said, holy shit, I got all these guys. And talk about getting guys out of a thing, you know. So I'm looking at the guy, and I don't know why. The little guy with a blue hat, but he just looked very sincere to me, you know? So I said, who are you? He says, I'm Ray Callanan from SB&J Engineering or something like that. I didn't really hear what he said to me, you know, but he looked like a sincere guy. So I said, all right. So I get on the radio. I start calling all the battalion chiefs on this side, that side. Then I said, well, let's get everybody off the damn thing. You know what I mean? Now, there's hundreds of guys working, and they're telling, this chief, he's a pain in the ass. We're making progress here. We're going to get this guy. And they'd all, like, as we all know, nobody wanted to go. I'm going to say it took 2.5 hours to get everybody off that hill. You know what I mean? And I don't even know if everybody was off. But down the very bottom, there was a couple of pumpers down there that were underground that we were digging out. I thought there might be people in there, stuff like that. Anyway, finally, I get everybody off 2.5 hours later. I'm looking around, trying to see what do we do now. All of a sudden, there's like a landslide from all around that seal. It goes all the way down, a tremendous kind of rock, chair, and whatever debris was down there went down there and filled up about another story on the bottom, but all the way down the hill. Every single guy that was hanging around that hill would have been down on the bottom of the hill underground. You know what I mean? I said, holy shit. I said, boy, I was saying, we're lucky to do that. And someone said to me, geez, Javi.
Yeah. Did you ever get the guy's name?
Give me a minute, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's,
someone said
that
to me,
like,
geez, how did you ever think of that? And I said, I didn't. This guy did behind me. So I turned around and looked for the guy.
Yeah.
I looked for the guy in the blue hat. He's gone, you know. I said,
Dad, I have to tell you, Tommy.
Jesus Christ, sneaking up on us, saving another 800 or 900 guys. And I was just damn glad I was around to be his agent, you know.
It's just incredible. Because it was a miracle that anybody didn't get hurt or killed in the cleanup.
It's just amazing. I mean, it was so dangerous, you know. And,
You
know, that – I thought you told me he had a white hat because I thought – I swear that was an angel. That was God sent him down there to talk.
I would believe that, but I don't know who else would.
I believe it. I mean, man, you told me that
you
story
know what
that hit. Yeah.
I don't even know if it was white or blue, but it was a construction helmet, like a little one like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just to make this miracle further, on the 14th, it was raining. I don't know if you call it 7th, 11th, down 11th, 12th, 14th. It was a Friday, Saturday night. I was down there again. It was raining like hell. And we had a transit set up on the side of the hotel because someone said, that looks like it's moving, you know, like straight up and down. It was and we'll just keep an eye on that. If that wall moves, we're going to get everybody out of here. You know what I mean? So it turns out I'm there again like that. And someone said, that wall moved. Look at the transit. So I looked at the transit, and it had moved about an inch. I said, holy shit. So now I get everybody out of there again. Like, but there wasn't, you know, there was only 40-something guys. This was before this. This was before this. About 40 guys out there. And I believe this guy, whoever the hell told me that the transit moved. It turned out that everybody was looking through the transit, kicking the legs on it and every other damn thing, and
right.
It was way out of level, and it didn't collapse. And then I was a little embarrassed that I got everybody out of there, and that's even more remarkable to me.
Right.
That
some instead of like
told me
home.
To believe this guy the second time, you know, to get everybody out of there. Part of the miracle, too.
I think so, too, because normally a normal person would say, like, yeah, right, why don't you just take a walk? You know, I've done this before, and you know, Brian Wolf, and wow, I said this numerous times that I see Ray at church all the time. We go basically to the same mass, you know, and I believe it, and you too, Tommy. That we were raised a certain way, and I think that there's someone looking out for us.
Oh God,
something?
Yes, sure, yeah. He looked like anybody. He looked like, I don't know who, you know. He looked like Harry Melichuk, for God's sake.
Harry.
Right?
Harry, I remember Harry. But
you can't forget Harry.
I just think it's remarkable is that you turned around and he was gone, because anyone would gloat. They'd be like, hey, I told you so, right? And the guy was gone, you know.
Yeah.
That's the right there, you know. So I got one good story. I have a happy story about 9/11. It's happy instead. You know, we all grew up in a city. We grew up in Irish neighborhoods, you know, Highbridge, Rog's Neck. I was in Woodside. And, you know, guys used to wear these clatter rings, right? You know, these new Irish guys, their grandmothers and mothers would give them a clatter. And I remember one night we were down in October. We're on a pile. And, you know how the guys were. They wanted to find our guys, you know. And they weren't so concerned about the civilians. I hate to say it. I mean, it's not that we didn't care about the civilians, but it was an emotional time, you know.
Oh, God.
And I remember one time, you know, I saw something, you know, there was a clattering, and I pointed it out to somebody. I said, hey, I called it in. I said, we got somebody, you know, and he's got a silver clattering on. It was silver. Most guys, I have a gold one, you know, my grandmother gave me a gold one. Somehow the word got back to one of the firemen from up in the 7th Division, I think 32 truck, who knew someone that was missing that had a silver clattering. He was able to get in contact with the family, and it turns out
wow.
that it was him. And, you know, even though, you know, I just felt like he was a young father. He had two girls, my kids' ages, you know. And I got to meet the family, though, from Ireland, you know, and she was so grateful that we found her son, you know. And it
yeah.
was like, it
oh,
was,
yeah.
There wasn't a dry eye in the place. You know, it was just, they hugged me, you know, and even though it's a tragedy, in a sense, it was still, you know, for her, it was a blessing that we found her son. Because if I never said something about that ring, you know, God knows if, you know, if, who knows what would happen, you know. So,
yeah,
you know, no, he worked in the, in the Wall Street, you know.
Okay.
So, you know, that's just one of thousands of stories. And, you know, we're coming up now to September 11th pretty quickly. It's going to be a different time, but
19 years.
Tommy, yeah. I hope that story told gets spread throughout, because that story needs to be told. Because, I mean, man, oh, man, if you didn't listen to that guy, God only knows what would happen. They'd still be talking about
it. Oh, yeah.
You know? And
every single day after that, like, I was on there really long. I was there till June. I was there till every other month till it was over. The guys, every chance I got, and I'd say, listen, this is a labor of love down here. This is an honor and a privilege for us to go down here and find our brothers and get them back to their families, you know? And it was.
Yeah, it was. I was there in March.
So sad I was there, and I'm so happy I was there.
Yeah, I was there in March, which was when we were wrapping it up, because we were pretty much at the bottom of that bath. Remember that bathtub or whatever, you know, that Tully Road. We were just at, you know, I don't want to get into too many details. I mean, you know, but we comforted a lot of families that month. It was a banner month that month, you know, and it was always, you know, it's just, you know, even though it was a tragedy, I mean, it was just we were able to help a lot of families that month, you know, and that's, you know, that's what we're all about. So, Tommy, I'm really honored. You know, it's amazing. We just found out that our families are from the same place in Ireland.
We got to check into that.
We got to check into that. The Kiernan family. You
oh
know,
yeah.
From, I mean, it's just a small world. You were in 58 engine, and in 58 engine Ray. You know, Ray's in 17 truck. You know, we work together. So, you know, we're all connected, you know.
Amen.
And I'm truly, like, honored. I mean, really, like, when I got on the job, I worshipped you guys. I read that book, 82 Engine. All I wanted to do was
report
for
Engine 82, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I found out that it was not only 82, but it was 60 and 71 and 41 and 83 and 73.
Yeah, you're right. It was
50.
Yeah,
you know, 85, and you know, it was all of you, you know, and I'm sure in Harlem too, and parts of Brooklyn.
Oh yeah,
I mean, they all did their war years, you know.
Yeah.
So,
Danny, let me tell you one thing before my oldest sister is still alive. Like, she's
94.
My sister, oldest sister. Like, I do is 16 years, you know. Anyway, she's a family historian, you know. Four of my sisters are dead. She's the oldest one. She's the one alive. Three of my brothers are dead. There's two of us left here. But she is really into that. She's a family history, and she doesn't know about this. I can't wait to tell her. You know, she'll be delighted to find out all this stuff. I'm so glad you tipped me off to that. You know, psyched out, you know.
I have it all written down, because when last time I was over there, well, like two times ago, we're still very close, you know. And they handed me like a little book, and it's got the whole Kiernan from Granard history, like all the, and we have foxes too. I told you, we have my grandmother had.
It's gotta be.
My grandmother had cousin foxes, James Fox. You know, unfortunately, he was killed on St. Stephen's Green. But you know, we had foxes,
yeah,
and they're from Westmeath. So there's got to be something there, Tommy. I'm sure.
Sure, yeah, there sure is. Yeah.
What a
I can't wait
world.
To get it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we're working on a project for fire engineering, and you're going to be very prominent in the book. So. I'm sure Bobby Halton's listening, and he heard that story, and I'm sure he can't wait to hear more about that story. So all you guys out there, I really didn't want to take many questions tonight. A lot of you guys I know listen to this on the podcast later on. I was just awed. I tell you, I got on the job, and I thought these guys walked on water. If you were 20 years and you were in the 6th Division, you were like a god. You know, you were – an icon. These guys, I'm telling you, that's they made the mold, and we're all now trying to fill their shoes, and I tell you, very very big shoes to fill, you know. And if I make that,
you know, Danny,
Tommy,
when you were mentioning Joe Kelly, that Ray and I know very well, he broke me.
Yeah.
He took me in on my first fire. Like he was an awesome man. I was a backup man. He put me under his arm when I put the fire. I was literally terrified, and he pushed me all the way through the thing. And I was a fireman right after that happened. I was a fireman.
My first job was
everything. Yeah, it was amazing.
Wire did nothing, and Bill Costello took me through the whole thing. He had about 8 months more than me on the job.
Yeah,
he was an experienced firefighter already.
Yeah, well, with that back then, I'll tell you a joke story, Joe. I worked in his groups, and I'm a probie. I'm scared out of my mind. He's me in the office, and he gives me the whole up and down, you know. And anyway, so I work with him a lot. And let me tell you something. They don't become any tougher than Joe Kelly. And he had a fire. I wasn't working, but let me tell you something. Talk about a miracle, right? Joe is sitting in the office, the 17 truck, and he's listening to the police scanner, right? And he hears a police officer. You ever heard the story, Ray?
I think I did.
He listens to a police officer from the 4-0 precinct on the radio look up and says, there's fire out the windows on the 13th floor of the address, whatever, Alexander Avenue. Joe hears this. He jumps on the pole, turns the company out. They race down there. He runs up the stairs. The father meets him. He says, my two kids are in there. Dusty past the father. They go under the fire. They grab these two kids, and they lift. Like Joe Kelly.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm golfing with him tomorrow. I'm going to tell him that story.
Hiya, Tom. Hiya, boy.
Yeah. I mean, let me tell you something. I was so blessed to have guys like Joe Kelly, Dennis Calliope, Billy Geis, Frank O'Grady.
Calliope's golfing tomorrow, too. Calliope and Kelly both golfing tomorrow.
I love it. I love it.
They don't make them any better.
Yeah.
I'm telling you. That was a true blessing to be under those guys, you know, wing. And I'm sure that, you know, if you mention say that crazy probie, that's for sure.
All right, Tom.
All right, Tommy.
God bless you. Hopefully I'll see you soon.
All right, Tommy.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. We'll talk soon.
All right, Danny. Thank you. And then keep in touch with the Cannons, all right? Get back to you. I'll get back to you.
Sorry, too, Tom.
All right. Take
all
care,
right.
guys.
All
bye
right, now. Danny.
Take care.
Go.
Thank you.
Right.
God
night,
bless
Tom.
All of us.
Amen.
Good night. All right. Thanks, Tommy.
Amen.
Give me one second.
All right. I got it.
I'm going to wrap it up right now. Just kind of, okay. Okay.
All right. So you're done. Worked out good.
I'm still talking. Hold on. All right, guys. Thanks. That was Ray Callanan and Tommy Fox, both from 71 and 55, 6th Division. We could have talked all night, but Ray's got to leave, and I got to shut it down. So, again, be safe out there, and I'll see you on the radio.
On the radio.
All right.
All right, Dan.
What do you think?
I think it was great.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good night. I'll see you soon, whatever.
I'll see you at church.